Good morning. I'm William Walgrave, the chairman of Coutts, and welcome to those of you who've joined us for what I think is the sixth of the Coutts in Conversation meetings, virtual meetings. Now, today, we hope that we have the Mayor of London joining us. As you can imagine, there he is. There is the Mayor of London joining us absolutely on the spot of time. Sadiq Khan, welcome. Just a brief word. This is, it's very good of you to join us. Now, we at Coutts, of course, has, and Adam, have clients all over the United Kingdom. Why are we concentrating on London? Well, pretty obviously, London is one of the great metropolises of the world. What happens in London affects the rest of the United Kingdom. And also, of course, the problems facing London are very much like the problems facing other big cities and conurbations throughout the kingdom. So the problems facing you, Mr. Mayor, are not so different from those facing your colleagues in Manchester and elsewhere. But welcome to you. You have been mayor succeeding. I can't remember who it was you succeeded, but you were a long-term councillor in Lambeth, Wandsworth, rather, before that, and a member of parliament in London. So you're a Londoner born and bred, and your roots in London politics are very deep. So welcome to you, and thank you for joining us today.
Pleasure to join you, William. It's lovely to speak to you. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
And I was once in a different world life a politician. The purpose of today, I'm jolly glad I was once Secretary of State for Health. I'm jolly glad I'm not Secretary of State for Health today. I expect most other people are too. But the purpose of the conversation today is obviously not to have a political argy-bargy, but to try to come to grips with some of the problems and issues facing you. And we've got a big participation from our clients with lots of questions in, and I'll try and spread them through the conversation. But can we start off with a little bit of a sort of personal approach? And we've actually had this as a question from somebody. You, in this very heavy task that's facing you, as facing all other decision takers in the area at the moment, and I think you've probably come straight from ministerial meetings to us today, which is very kind of you. What's been the most difficult thing? Laura asked this, one of our clients. What's been the most difficult thing that's faced you in all this? And how has it affected you personally? Because you're carrying a big burden.
No, firstly, it's a pleasure to speak to you, William, and to join those who are viewing this from their home or the office. I've just come actually from a meeting with Grant Shapps. And it's just worth saying, because sometimes people don't realise is, by and large, politicians get on. I think this is impression created. You know this, William, from the time you're in Parliament. By and large, we get on. And in fact, we work collegially together. So just come from a meeting with the Secretary of State for Transport. On Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, I spoke to the Health Secretary on every day. And I spoke yesterday, of course, to the Prime Minister. So by and large, we all realise we're on the same side here, dealing with the virus. The enemy is the virus. The opponent is the virus, and not each other. Of course, there's differences, which sometimes are reported, and often I report them or the government reports them. I mean, lots of difficult things over the last few months. I mean, to pick one is difficult. One of the things I've tried to do, William, is to not lose sight of the fact that we're talking about a virus that impacts human beings. Yes, it affects businesses, but we've had lots of Londoners who've lost their lives over the last few months directly because of the virus. One of the biggest challenges was transport workers. We know about health workers, care workers, and others. But the most difficult decision I made, there's been a few, one of them must have been to keep public transport running, even though in March, April, we weren't quite clear what's happening with the virus. And so what we did at the same time was to make sure we made public transport as safe as possible with various things I can talk about later on if need be. But it was important to keep it running. Why? Because we know this virus accelerates if there's no social distancing. So if we reduce capacity and people have to use public transport to get to work, if they're a nurse or a doctor or a shopkeeper, a retailer or whatever, by closing public transport down, it's a problem. And so keeping it going was a tough decision. I think it was the right one, at the same time as an enhanced cleaning regime. What I've done though, William, linked with that, is I've written to every bereaved family who works in transport to pass on my condolences, to reach out because I appreciate there are bereaved families who will never come to terms with having lost their loved ones. Mm. The other big thing, just because it's relevant to Laura's question, and I'm sure it's relevant to many of those who work for Coutts or are clients, is being honest about the impact on me. And so I've tried to not be this typical alpha male leader talking about how brave and strong I am, but to be honest about the impact on my mental health, the impacts on me, because I appreciate by me being honest, it allows others to talk about it because they think hopefully if the mayor's talking about it, we can talk about our vulnerabilities. And so a number of things I can talk about, but those are probably the two biggest difficult challenges and decisions that I've made.
Well, thank you for that and for being so open about that, about those things. Now, at the heart of many of the questions I've received, as you can imagine, is are we getting the balance between the economy and the health protection right? It's extremely difficult. I have to declare an interest. My family owns a small pub in Dorset Street, and I suppose I better not advertise it, in Marylebone. But that business is having, as you can imagine, very, very grave difficulties at the moment. There were quite a lot of people who were asking, was it right to put up the congestion charge when we were trying to help people back into the centre? Because although, as you say, public transport's still working, a lot of people have to come in by car if they're going to come in. And was that a difficult decision? I mean, it's coming from quite a lot of flack for quite a number of our questions, as you can imagine.
Well, I'll answer the second question is easy. Actually, it wasn't difficult because I was told to do it by the government. The government said, unless you agree to reintroduce the congestion charge, but also to widen the scope and the level, you're going to get a grant. As simple as that. So actually, that was quite an easy thing because had I not signed up to those conditions, TfL would run out of money and we'd have had to cut services. And by the way, TfL was in a fit, healthy state. I'd managed to reduce the operating deficit by 86% from when I first became mayor. I'd increased the cash balances by 31%, what, £2.1 billion, but the money had run out. And so actually that was relatively easy. What was more difficult is in relation to my concern that we as politicians, and I point the finger at the government, haven't been honest with people about the balance that's required. So on the one hand, there's the need for increased economic activity that you touched upon. On the other hand, there's the need to protect and preserve public health. And I think earlier on, we should have been far more upfront with people across the country about the consequences of the various steps we're going to take in relation to lockdown, but also say it's not a choice between wealth and health or between lives and livelihoods. They're inextricably linked. If the health crisis gets worse, it leads to an economic crisis becoming even worse. And so one of the things that we've got to do, William, you know, you did this when you were a member of the cabinet, but also in government. I think it's maybe Harold Wilson line. We've got to be educators. We've got to educate the public at the same time we're doing stuff. And I think one of the things we failed to do, and I speak regularly to mayors across the globe and leaders across the globe, I think other leaders in other countries have been far more successful and explaining the opportunity cost or the cost benefit, why we're doing stuff and taking people with them. How do we, for example, survive economically without a vaccine or without immunization? What do we do? And so, for example, you'll be aware, for some time I was lobbying about the importance of wearing face masks for ages and the government wouldn't listen. There was a libertarian argument from the government versus my pragmatic argument saying, look, we've got to learn to live with this virus. They finally moved, and I think actually what you see in the Far East in particular, in societies that had previous viruses, pandemics, SARS, and all the rest of it, is they realised that part and parcel of living in a global city is wearing a face mask. And there are other things we could talk about, but I agree with you that the congestion charge increase, and it being 7 days a week, has caused real challenges. One of the things I said to the Secretary of State today was, if your ends is to raise increased revenues, let me decide the way to do that. I don't think a blunt instrument, 7 days a week, 6 a.m. to 9 p.m., 15 quid, is the way to do so in the short term, when, as you said, for many people, often for good reasons, the car maybe, they can't walk, they can't cycle, they can't use public transport, maybe the best option. And so, fingers crossed, when it comes to the second half of the financial deal, there'll be fewer strings attached from the government and more autonomy for me to make the tough choices that I'm elected to make.
Now, London's a resilient city. It's got a long history. 60 years ago, it was being, we had the Blitz, you know, we had the Great Plague of London, which killed a quarter of the population. We had terrorist attacks in 2005. London's very resilient and comes back. But I've had some questions. And Tommaso asked this. I mean, what's our vision? Do we think that London is going to recover to be like it was before? Do we think the great arts centres, the great entertainment centres that make this a global centre for so many people, do you think we're going to see that come back to what it was before?
I'm really, really pleased you used the word resilient, William, when you asked the question. Yes, we are resilient. We always bounce back better, actually. I think if you look at all the previous examples you've given of things that have affected us, great fires, great plagues, the Blitz, the terrorism we saw in the 70s, 80s and 90s. In fact, 2017, we had four terror attacks, Grenfell Tower fire. We always bounce back better. The resilience is a key part of that. The can-do attitude is a key part of that. But it's not just blind sort of bingoism or indeed nativism. It's born with the evidence we have of being pragmatic and fleet-footed. So yes and no to your question. We are going to continue to be the world's greatest city, but we're going to be different. I think this new normal, or what people call build back better, I think there's something to this. I'll give you an example. Actually, our future as a global city must be one that's more greener in relation to the future of our city. We now know that many people are choosing to do leisure at home, more leisure at home, to do more work at home, and to more play at home. Well, that provides an opportunity and a challenge. What is the future of retail? What is the future of culture? And actually, one of the things we've got to do is make the experience of whether it's shopping or going to watch a movie or to the theater or to a gallery far better doing it in person than doing it at home. So we've got the innovation in our city. And one of the things that we've got that many other great cities haven't got is our unique ecosystem. So not simply the world's greatest financial center, life sciences, universities, the tech, the culture, the galleries, the schools, and on. And so we'll never lose that, the language, the time zone, but we've got to realize that we can't be complacent. It's complacency that's our biggest challenge, actually, William, not necessarily a pandemic, which other global cities around the world are going through. You speak to the mayor of New York or the governor of New York about Manhattan, or you speak to the mayors of Paris or the governor of Tokyo, as I do, all facing big, big challenges. I'm really confident, though, our underlying strengths are such, and I include, by the way, the possibility of a no-deal Brexit, that we'll withstand all those things. And because of the word resilience, we'll get through it. But the key thing is to make sure we can have a new normal that makes us resilient for the next pandemic or for the next challenge we face.
Now, one little bit of building back better, which I'm not going to be forgiven for not asking you, or two bits, actually. One from Jeremy, and I sympathize with him, which is that...
Can I just check Jeremy's surname?
No, you can't. That would be deep breach of every...
Because there are some Jeremys that you and I might not agree with. There are others we may agree with.
Oh, Jeremys. There are lots of good Jeremys out there. This one makes a point which I have some sympathy with, which is that compared to some great cities, including some cities in the UK, our broadband is pretty feeble in parts of London. Now, what's happening on this? BT is rolling out full fibre in Birmingham and Leeds. What are we up to? Because it's very surprising to some people that we're not world leaders world leaders in a lot of the stuff that goes into the internet. Why aren't we world leaders in the infrastructure in London?
Well, let me first explain the challenges to Jeremy and what we're doing about it. So Jeremy's right, partly. So when I first became mayor, I was quite aware of this big challenge we had. And there are a number of reasons why we have these challenges. One, we're a very old city. So unlike many cities that have better, fiber connection, that they're newer cities and they can build into the city planning full fiber. And so we've got that disadvantage. The other disadvantage in terms of full fiber rollout is we have, rightly in my view, 33 autonomous boroughs. The challenge that has, great for democracy, bad for if you're a Vodafone or a BT and you're trying to roll stuff out, there are 33 different planning regimes. It's a nightmare. So what I've done since I've been mayor is a number of things. Firstly, I've appointed our city's first chief digital officer, basically an idea pinch from New York. Having one person who's looking at all this stuff, and Theo Blackwell's doing a great job coordinating the 33 boroughs, so there can be one joined up planning regime. So if you're somebody who wants to roll out full fiber, it's easier to do so. Two, trying to get uniform agreements with those that own the premises. One of the big challenges we have, William, is fiber to the premises. Big challenge for some people. So we're trying to get uniform agreements that can be used all around the city. But the third big opportunity we have is I run the underground. So what I'm doing is, in the underground, using the underground, the tunnels we've got, and the various public buildings across our city with the town halls, to have a full fiber spine running through our city, so the connections will be very easy to be picked up across our city. And we're making massive progress doing that. And I'm optimistic in the very near future, people will see the fruits of that. We've now got 4G on the Jubilee line, another innovation that we're doing. Our challenge again, because our underground is the oldest in the world, some are deep tunnel, and there are some challenges that poses both with air conditioning and with full fiber. But to say to Jeremy, you know, watch this space. We've made huge progress. If you speak to many of the tech companies, they will confirm that progress we've made over the last 3-4 years. I'll give you another one, Jeremy. We've got a London office for technology and innovation. So one of the big challenges we have is we don't share data enough. So from TfL, I'm giving all our data free to the private sector to use as they see fit with, you know, journey planning and all the rest of it. But also I'm trying to persuade local authorities to release their data when it comes to planning or whatever, so the private sector can be innovative. And the final thing I just say, William, is I've now said to anybody who wants to build a new building, you've got to treat internet connection as an essential public utility, just like you do water, gas, electric. You've got to, as part of the condition of getting permission, have full fiber getting to that new development. And so Jeremy will see, William, a big change very, very swiftly. And when I speak to business leaders, they welcome the changes we've brought about. And I'm just frustrated it's taken us this long to get there.
Thank you for that. Another bit of more traditional infrastructure, and I'm not going to be forgiven by Alex and Drew if I don't put this to you. When's the Hammersmith Bridge going to be open again? And what's happening about that? Because if you live at the other end of it, I have friends actually. My old colleague Chris Patton lives in Barnes. It takes about 3 weeks to get to Barnes now. So what is happening about Hammersmith Bridge?
Well, but by the way, when you see Chris Patton, some of his books on diplomacy is what I've read to prepare myself to meet Tory ministers, and it's quite a good books to read. So let me explain to those of your viewers who don't live in West London the issue with Hammersmith Bridge. Hammersmith Bridge is almost 150, 200 years old, Victorian bridge, wood, steel, and for decades now it's had real problems because of cracks. It's not a new thing. In April last year, it was sufficiently serious for the council that owned the bridge to close the bridge down to vehicles, but keep it open for pedestrians and cyclists. But we knew that the cost of repairing the bridge, the council couldn't afford to pay for. We don't own the bridge, but nor could we, even if we had locus of the bridge. Notwithstanding that, I put aside £25 million from my budget to look at how we can get the bridge reopened as soon as possible. And in the meantime, I said to the government, look, listen, government, the council can't fix this bridge, they own it. I can't fix this bridge, I don't own it, we've not got the money to do so. Let's work together, government, mayor, council, businesses, other councils, to find a solution. The government unfortunately didn't step up, so we carried on trying to find a solution. This August, the cracks got worse to the point the council took a decision to even stop pedestrians and cyclists using the bridge, so it's completely closed. It's caused chaos in West London, chaos. Buses have been diverted for some time now, cyclists are diverted. Children can't go from one side of the river to the other and are doing big loops. And so what I'm saying to the government is the cost of repairing the bridge is roughly speaking circa £145 million. We can't afford it, TfL. The council can't afford it. You're going to have to step in because there's no other options on the table. And two, it's possible to do some short-term repairs on the bridge to get it open at the very least to pedestrians and cyclists, about £40 million, which can be a short-term way, but also for the short-term, some vehicles can get across. And one of the things, William, just to reassure your people asked the question is, the fact that the government are now engaging is really good. The government have agreed to set up, they have set up a task force. it's not just a talking shop, I'm hoping. We are meeting weekly, the council leaders on both sides, officials from the government and TfL, and fingers crossed there'll be some good news here. But frankly speaking, unless the government gives us financial support, there is no other show in town to get this bridge reopened. And that, those of your viewers, those who have, you know, are part of this conversation, who live locally, if you could please lobby the government with us, we'd really appreciate that. And it's not party political, by the way. This bridge has had decades of issues and stuff. It's about central government having to step in, because this is a major artery of our city. You know, those on the southern side can't make journeys because of the bridge being closed.
Thank you. Now, I've had lots some of them quite cross questions about transport in various ways. I mean, the problem for London is one of the problems for London is that it's a very difficult, because of the reason you give, it's an ancient city. And in spite of the bombing and the war and so on, it has very intricate street patterns and so on. It's not an easy city to make for cyclists. It's not like Rotterdam or Paris or somewhere with great wide boulevards. I've had a lot of people questioning whether the combination of changed through routes and of cycle routes has made London's traffic now so congested, even in this time, I mean, it's in the last few weeks when it's been back to action again, that it really is harming business. How do you respond to that?
This is a really good question. So I've studied, but I was wanting to be mayor, and also since the history of our city, but also what the projections are. So our city's population over the last 2-3 decades has gone from 7 million, 8 million, 9 million. The projections are, even with COVID, by 2030, 10 million plus, and it's growing exponentially. In fact, the world is becoming more urban. The world's population, roughly speaking, 45% used to live in cities. Recently, a few years ago, 2-3 years ago, it will be 65% over the next few decades. So we've got to realize our cities are becoming more populated, and we've got to prepare for that and plan for that. It is simply not possible for us to have more cars on our road. You've seen, with a slight increase in car usage, London being gridlocked. It causes massive problems for our emergency services, massive problems for deliveries. And by the way, more people are having deliveries to their home, which causes big challenges. So, and that's, we're not even talked about Ubers and private eye vehicles. And so we can't afford, frankly speaking, to have more cars on our road. One of the things that I did was look at those cities around the world who have had the virus before us and what recoveries they've had. And in the Far East in particular, the car-led recovery has been catastrophic, because it's led from one health crisis, COVID, being replaced by a different one, air quality. And so I support the government, and I think Boris Johnson deserves credit here, not words I usually say, and Grant Shapps, for trying to work where possible with cities and regions to avoid a car-led recovery. That means we're providing in London 100% public transport capacity, unlike other parts of the country and other parts of the world. Why? To encourage people to use public transport safely, avoid the rush hour if you can, but also we're encouraging people to walk and cycle. Wide enough pavements, also more segregated pavements, to encourage people to cycle safely. And so we're doing that to avoid a car-led recovery. But I recognize some people, for good reasons, may not be able to use public transport, may not be able to walk, may not be able to cycle. And that's one of the reasons we want to free up the roads for those people who are doing so. But it's a challenge, because you're right, most of the main roads in London are 2 lanes, at best 3, which causes huge problems when there is a gridlock. So there's 3 big things we're doing on our roads. One, something called street space. Widening pavements in those parts of our city that are congested so you can keep a social distance. The Prime Minister's confirmed we've got at least 6 months more of this, at least. And part of that is segregated cycle lanes. It's called street space. 2, have more what I call school streets. What do I mean by that? At the times when school starts and school finishes, roads outside schools to be just for pedestrians, cyclists and scooters. Why? To encourage more parents and carers with their children to walk, cycle or scooter to school rather than taking their car. Most journeys in London in the car are less than 1 kilometre. They tend to be mums, dads, carers dropping off kids, so we're doing that. And the third part, which is controversial, is what's called low traffic neighbourhoods. This is a really good idea the government's got, which I support, which is giving to councils, not me, councils money to reimagine their streets and their boroughs. That's been controversial, William, because what's often happened is overnight, councils have changed roads, cut what were, inverted commas, right runs, which has led to people getting in the car the next day and suddenly having a roadblock, these planters in the way. And what councils have realised from that is it was a mistake to do so overnight. So councils are now engaging, tweaking, amending, improving, or doing a U-turn if those low traffic neighbourhood policies aren't working. And what I'd say to your people who have called in who are angry is, you know, the intentions and the motives from the government, from us and councils are good. Work with us to try and finesse, improve and tweak them, because there is no alternative to, you know, trying to avoid a carnage recovery, because we have in London levels of nitrogen dioxide, nitrogen oxide, carbon emissions, particulate matter, that leads to children having permanently stunted lungs, adults with a whole host of health issues from asthma, dementia, cancer, and other issues. And so we can't replace one health crisis with another. And I'm hoping the new normal we talked about will be one where people are encouraged to walk, cycle, or use public transport rather than jumping in their car.
Thank you for that. It brings us back in a sense to, and this is a question from John and Caroline, but from everybody, everybody of my age, because I'm by being 70 plus in a vulnerable category, and we're still a bit anxious about using public transport. Now, because, you know, and I'll be quite frank, I still try and avoid it if I can. What can you do to make people like me feel a bit more secure in the underground? My usual journeys were basically underground journeys, sometimes buses, but you're basically underground.
Well, firstly, I understand your concerns. I understand those people who have got family members who may be, inverted commas, vulnerable, not just because of age, but because they could have underlying health conditions. Sure. So a number of things. Firstly, I can say with confidence that we have in London some of the most enhanced cleaning regime of any transport authority in the world. What do I mean by that? We are using a hospital quality antiviral disinfectant across the entire estate, buses, tubes, trams, overground, common touch points. During the course of the day they're cleaned, but also we're using longer lasting film protection to make sure a public transport is clean. I'm not content that we should mark our own homework. So we've asked Imperial College to come and measure, assess, analyze how clean public transport is. And so Imperial College are working with us. They just turn up, do their tests, and touch wood. So far, they've found no example anywhere on the underground where there's been any example of the virus, which is fantastic. We've also made sure that we lobby the government about the importance of wearing face masks. We've got additional British Transport officers and TfL enforcement officers trying to enforce the face mask rule. William, the reason why the face mask rule is important is many people who have the virus are asymptomatic, or they could be pre-symptomatic. You would not know you've got the virus. But wearing a face mask doesn't stop you necessarily catching the virus, it stops you passing it on. And so if I wear a face mask, I keep you safe. If you wear one, you keep me safe. The good news is on the underground, the numbers of people wearing a face mask is 90%. 5% have got a very good reason why they can't wear a face mask. They could have a respiratory issue or another issue, but there are 5% who are breaking the rules. And so we have issued a number of fixed penalty notices. We've kicked off the underground some people who refuse to put it on, and we've stopped people entering who are wearing a face mask. But we continue to keep this under review, and we're making sure we keep our underground as clean as we can. And the other advice I'm giving commuters is, for someone like yourself or others, please avoid the rush hour unless you've got a very, very, very good reason to use the underground. So between 6:30 and 8:45, avoid the underground, and between 3:45 and 5:30. Why? Because it's very difficult to keep a social distance if you are, you know, sort of cheap by jowl. And so the good news is, by and large, people can keep their social distance. And just to give you an idea of some reassurance, the numbers of people using the underground is about 35%. So it's possible to use so safely. On the buses, it's about 50-55%. And on the buses, we've laid on additional buses when schools start and when schools finish in. And some of the buses have a sign saying schools buses. So I'd ask you to avoid those buses, because on those buses, there'll be children who won't be keeping their social distance, and to use the other buses, which is every other bus, which social distance is being respected, and you should feel safer.
Thank you for that. I haven't know. One of our colleagues in the bank I was talking to the other day was in the underground. There was a man opposite her not wearing a mask. She politely rebuked him and got sworn at and shouted at the end of which he said, "Now, don't you think that stupid mask you're wearing is protecting you?" And she said, "No, it's protecting you," which was exactly the right answer. But there are people out there who don't play by the rules, but there are plenty who do, great majority do.
Just to give you a stat, so if you don't wear a face mask, there's a, I beg your pardon, if you do wear a face mask, the chances of the virus not being passed on is sixfold. That's the difference it makes, it's between 15% and 85%.
Right. Now, I'm going to go off in a different direction, if I may, for a moment. I think you're the first observant Muslim to be the mayor of a great city anywhere in the world. And that's a very good thing to see in our diverse country and a wonderful symbol. Well, it's a bit more than a symbol. You're a bit more than a symbol. You're a mayor. So many of our colleagues in the bank and many of our clients are concerned by and in some cases worried by the issues that surround diversity and equality, the BAME issues, the Black Lives Matter that have been brought into focus by Black Lives Matter. And there's an anxiety that the sort of attack that COVID has made on the fabric of society by separating us all into different groups has worsened things in some respects in people's perception. I don't know whether you think that's true. But what's in your mind as the way that we can avoid the wrong sort of divisions within our society and bring people together again?
Yeah, no, thanks for your question and what you said. So can I just make this point? It refers to a previous question you asked about London and our resilience. I think it should be a source of tremendous pride to Londoners that Londoners chose as their mayor somebody who is, as you said, it's just a fact, an ethnic minority and a religious minority. Why is that important? Because you're aware around the globe, there are these, you know, populist nationalist movements trying to divide communities. And our response in London is to elect as our mayor somebody like me. And to me, diversity is a strength, not a weakness. And in answer to your question, actually, although we may be physically separated, this conversation shows we're not separated, actually. And I think one of the things that COVID has done is it's accelerated the use of technology to bring people together. We're doing projects across the city, William, particularly for older people who may be lonely, giving them free iPads with charities so they can not be lonely. And we've got, you know, children reading to older people and a whole host of things we're doing using technology. And I speak regularly to faith leaders from the Archbishop to the Bishop of the Catholic Church to the Chief Rabbi to Muslim imams to Hindu priests and Sikh priests. And what faith communities do, bringing people together during this time, has been quite enormous, from mutual aid to food banks to helping with loneliness and on. So I never talk down religion. I do religion, and I do see the power and good of faith. But it is a challenge, because actually one of the things people in my profession can do to try and win votes is to play on people's fears. What I'd rather do is address them and see what and ask, what are you worried about? Let's try and address those challenges. And I think what COVID has done is actually it's made us realize, we saw it every Thursday, clap for carers, that actually whether it's the NHS, whether it's you know, care workers, whether it's those working in our shops, working in our transport, we're a very pluralistic, diverse city. In fact, you've seen this, not just amongst those who work in Coutts and your clients, but actually those who go around our city. And that to me is a source of pride. And we've got to make sure we don't lose that. And one of the things that I'm really, really, it's just so inspiring is seeing when I speak to, virtually, of course, those who looked after our sickest, those who looked after those who are the most vulnerable, they were ethnically diverse and religiously diverse as well. And that's the best antidote to the hatred or the division. And I think we should be quite confident. Our values are far more powerful than the values of those who seek to divide us. And I'm really confident that actually we'll come through this stronger. The fact that more Londoners now know that during the month of Ramadan I fast, so I don't take food or water and stuff, is great. The fact that people understand the different cultures, the fact that the Archbishop can invite me into Lambeth Palace and we can break bread together and talk about what we have in common, it's fantastic. And I think other cities look at us with envy. Genuinely, they look at us with envy. And I think that's one of the things we've tried to do is to celebrate our diversity, to promote it. And the final thing I'll say in this is, the great thing about London is we don't tolerate difference. You tolerate a toothache. I don't mean tolerated. We respect it, we celebrate it, and we embrace it. And I think long may that continue.
Well, I think that'll find an echo with very many of our listeners and with the people working Coutts. Thank you for that. And meanwhile, we've got culture wars running on which statues we should pull down and all that and so on, and which ones we shouldn't. Do you have views on that? I mean, you can make a case against anybody really who was whose statue was put up, sometimes by public subscription at the time, in a different era. But what's your view?
You know, firstly, I think we should avoid a culture war. Wars generally are bad, and a culture war is not one I want to sign up to. The way I respond to this is quite simple, actually. History is complicated, and some of the people that we revere who in the past have complicated histories. And by the way, even in Parliament Square, people that both you and I respect and admire, from Churchill to Gandhi, have complicated histories, to Mandela, right? My point is a different one going forward. We should hope that our public realm fully reflects the contribution made by a diverse group of people. In my view, is a source of embarrassment. There aren't enough statues of women in our city. I'm really proud as the mayor. In Parliament Square, the first ever statue of a woman was one that I commissioned, working with great campaigners, and militant forces now in Parliament Square. I want to see more of our LGBTQ plus community, Black, Asian, minority, ethnic, women celebrated across the public realm in our city, whether it's murals, blue plaques, statues, street names, names of squares, on the rest. There's a separate discussion about whether some statues, and we're talking about, in my view, a handful at the moment that I can think of, top of my head, whether we should still be memorializing them in 2020, bearing in mind, actually, the time they were put up, there was a different attitudes towards those people, and whether a better place for them may not be memorialized in a public square, but maybe in a museum. And the obvious example are well-known slavers. But those are discussions we can have in a courteous, polite manner. It shouldn't be you and I making judgments because we've got our own prejudices. It should be a group of people with diverse views having a conversation. And also, by the way, I think the way we tell history should be more accurate. I think, look, I grew up, somebody born in this country, raised in this country, never fully understanding the contribution my forefathers and foremothers made in the First and Second World War, if I'm honest. I didn't know until quite recently about the 2.5 million people who fought in the First and Second World War. I didn't realize that, you know, that I should be proud of the Allied effort in the First and Second World War and on. And so there's a separate discussion about history and what's taught in our schools. But I think culture wars is not a good place for anybody, but we should discuss in an open, candid manner the contribution made by people in the present and the past.
Thank you. Plenty of subcontinental names on the Menin Gate, I can assure you. They should be honoured. I quite agree with you. Well, now we come back at the end, and we are coming to the end, I'm afraid. And thank you very much for your time today. I mean, we're all busy, but you're super busy just at the moment. The balance between building back the economy and protecting health in the next phase. The winter's going to be difficult. Have you got a sort of final thing you'd like to leave with us before I say thank you for your time today, that you'd like to leave with us for the winter, which is going to be tough, I think?
First, I think, listen, we should all have hope. We should all be optimistic about the future. You know, it is tough in the short to medium term, tough for a variety of reasons. We have to get a grip on this virus. We've got to get testing sorted out. We've got to get contact tracing sorted out. We've got to persuade the government of support for those sectors. William talked about, you know, hospitality and pubs. Those sectors who, you know, frankly speaking, with lower footfalls will not survive. And so we've got to keep them going. Hospitality, culture, retail, leisure, tourism. We've got to make sure that we can persuade the government to do a deal with the EU in relation to what happens on the 31st of December. But even withstanding and notwithstanding those challenges, I'm so optimistic about our future because the point I made, Londoners, you know, we are the best reason why I'm optimistic about our future, our innovation, our capacity to adapt, our capacity to find solutions when there are challenges posed before us, the can-do attitude, or as I say, the can't-do attitude of many, many people in our city. So look, William, it's been great talking to you. Can I thank, by the way, not just the bank, not just the clients you've got, but for others for continuing to see that London is a great place to invest. It's a great place to live. It's a great place to visit. None of that's going to change. In the next few weeks, we have got coming to our city. They are still coming. Foreign students. They've chosen London because they've seen the difference London can make to their, you know, future career prospects, their future life chances. You know, the current leaders in the world, it's quite remarkable, it should be a source of pride, who have lived in London, if not studied in London or worked in London, should be a real source of pride for us. No other city in the world can say that. We can. So look, thanks for talking to me. Thanks for listening. Thanks for engaging. And if there's any other, William, questions you've got, just ping me an email and I promise to respond offline to those of your people watching who had questions for me.
There may be plenty of those. Mayor Sadiq Khan, thank you very much for joining Coutts in Conversation today. Thank you very much indeed.
Stay safe. Take care. Ta-ra.